Hi, good evening, everybody. Hope everybody's doing well and staying warm. And for those of you who are a little under the weather, I appreciate your taking the time to come anyway. We're continuing. We're actually going to try and get to two Mishnayos tonight. They're very much linked, and I'm hoping that we can get through both of them. So here we go. We're going to continue chapter one. We're up to number eight. Where are we here? Here we go. Right, here we go. Yehuda ben Tabai, Yehuda the son of Tabai, and Shimon ben Shetach, Kiblu Mehem, they received the tradition from the previous two, who we said were Yoshua ben Prachya and Ittai Har Beili. And he said the following, Al tas atzmacha ke'orchei hadayanim. You'll like this, Robin. This is right up your alley. When sitting in judgment, do not act as a lawyer. When sitting in judgment, do not act as a lawyer, number one. Number two, kishiyu balei hadin omdim lefanecha, when the litigants are standing before you, yiyu be'einecha kirishaim. You shall continue. They're very soft in the translation here. They translate it as consider them both guilty. My text reads that it should be in your eyes like the wicked. The litigants should be viewed as wicked. But when they leave your courtroom, right? They should be regarded as righteous. When they have accepted upon themselves the ruling that you have rendered the decision with. This Mishnah is telling us from a judge's perspective, three things that we need to keep in mind. Number one, when you're the judge, don't be the counselor. Don't be the lawyer. What does that mean? I don't want to put Robin because she's got her voice.
I can say it. It's okay. I'm
So
a little bit.
share with us what is so terrible if the person behind the bench, the judge, is acting as a lawyer? What's so
And I
terrible?
should say, strangely enough, the judges, we have a lot of clients opposite me that aren't represented. And the judges always say, I cannot be the lawyer. They actually tell them, I cannot be the lawyer. So it's like they must have read this. But
Why?
the
What's
reason
so
is because I'll tell you the reason is because when you're the lawyer, when I'm a lawyer for my client, I only advocate for one side. I'm advocating one side. I'm not looking at both sides.
Okay. So is it fair to say that your main objective, or I should say, the only objective as a judge, is to remain impartial? Is that fair?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, they're
To
supposed to be.
remain impartial and to render a fair judgment.
Right.
Okay, I think I'll totally agree with that. That on the basic level, the most important thing to keep in mind as a judge is you must remain objective. You cannot show any kind of favoritism. The Torah, throughout the Torah, has many, many different prohibitions and warnings about remaining impartial. I'll give you an example. The halacha is, the Talmud states this outright, that if two litigants come before the judge in judgment, one dressed well and one dressed less well, one in rags and one wearing an exquisite garment worth a significant amount of money, we tell the judge has to say that one of the two has to change. Either upgrade the guy in rags or downgrade the guy in the fancy suit. But they have to be on equal footing. Why? Listen to the words the Torah says, distance yourself from falsehood. Midvar sheker, from the words of falsehood, tirchak. Midvar sheker tirchak. Distance yourself from falsehood. Let's talk about that for a moment. It doesn't say don't lie. The Torah does not need, obviously, you're not allowed to. It falls under. Anybody want to guess which of the Ten Commandments under the subcategory would be don't ever tell a lie?
Bear false witness.
False witness. That is correct. Number nine, to bear false witness. That is correct. That's right. As a subcategory, that's talking about perjury. That's talking about lying under oath. right? But it applies even in the basic between two people, not in a courtroom, not with any judgment, but just to say something that is not true, something that is false. That is a subcategory of commandment number nine. When it comes to generally any kind of falsehood, any kind of trickery, the Torah says not don't lie. The Torah says distance yourself from falsehood. Note the wording. Doesn't say limiting it to don't do it. You have to take steps to distance yourself from it. I want to show you how far this goes. We just finished, the book of Bereshit, and we're all familiar, at least it should still be fresh in our minds, the story of Yosef and his brothers. Joseph and his brothers. The ending is an amazing Hollywood script. It really is. When he reveals himself and they're totally discombobulated, they don't know what to make of it. He fine, they come down. Let's fast forward to the very, very end. Yaakov and his family come down to Egypt. And they're there for 17 years, and Yaakov finally passes away. He had made Joseph promise that he would not be buried in Egypt. Rather, he would be taken out of Egypt and up to the land of Canaan, to the Ma'arad HaMachpelah, to the cave of Machpelah, found in the city of Hebron, right? In Hebron. Okay? So they get there, they bury him. Okay? All the brothers came, there's an entourage from Egypt, everybody's there. The Torah, interestingly, if you read the words carefully, it implies that after the burial, Yosef returned to Egypt and his brothers returned to Egypt. The fact that the Torah splits it and doesn't say Yosef and his brothers went back to Egypt, but rather implying Yosef had one route to get to Egypt and the brothers took a different route. Why? The Torah itself doesn't tell us, but the Midrash fills us in a little bit here. And the Midrash tells us a fascinating thing. Yosef went on his way back to Egypt, you'll forgive the pun, but he made a pit stop. And I use the term very literally, because on his way back, Joseph stopped at the pit in which he was thrown so many years ago by his brothers. Now, the Torah does tell us that the brothers notice this and they immediately come to him and they start saying, well, our father, before he passed away, told us that we should ask forgiveness. And they start pleading because they think that Yosef now is going to take revenge. Now that Jacob is out of the picture, he's only been holding on because he doesn't want to hurt his father's feelings. Dad is no longer here. Oh, this is a perfect time. Yosef must be going back to the pit. So he riles himself up to go get revenge against his brother. So they start saying, no, Dad said you should forgive us, and yada, 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 yada. Yosef says, I don't know what you're talking about. I have no intention of taking revenge. Everything that this was for was so that God put me in the right place to save the family, etc., etc. The Midrash goes on to say, why did Yosef, in fact, go back to the pit? Anybody want to venture a guess? If it wasn't to get himself, psych himself out so that he could take revenge and rile himself up, why did he go back to the pit on the way down to Egypt?
Kind of think of where he was before he.
Why now?
Some kind of a look backwards for some reason.
Okay, you're going in the right direction, Fred. You see, there's a general concept, and we're all familiar with it. I'm not telling you anything you don't know. If you are a believing person, if you believe that there's a God and God oversees events, both on a world level, on a global level, as well as on a little old me level, then you have to be able to see a big picture. Let's put the whole story of Yosef as if we're playing it on 1.5 or 2 times the speed, right? We're not going to go through it all of it, but let's just highlight the main points. Joseph is the favorite son of Jacob. There's a jealousy. He goes out to check on his brothers. The brothers want to kill him. They decide to throw him in the pit instead of killing him. He gets sold down to Potiphar, right? He becomes successful. They have the whole incident of Potiphar's wife. He languishes in prison for 12 years, interprets the dreams, gets Pharaoh's dream interpreted, gets elevated to the viceroy of Egypt, is living the lavish life. There's a famine. The brothers come down. They don't recognize him. He recognizes them, right? Wouldn't it be great if we learned the Chumash this way, right? And what happens is he goes ahead and he plays rough with them and he finally reveals himself because he sees that they didn't want to give up Benjamin. They want to save him. They learned their lesson and he reveals himself and everybody moves down and everybody's happy and the Jewish people are in a good place. Right? Is that a fair synopsis? Yosef is privileged in his own lifetime to see the fulfillment of his prophecy about becoming king and seeing how the whole story played out for the good. You see, you and I don't always get that opportunity. We have events in our life that we still scratch our heads. We don't fully see the picture. It's hard for us to make heads or tails because we're not privileged to see the big picture. I forget which class I told this. Maybe I told it here about the guy who comes to shul for the first time. Did I tell it here? I think I told it here. He comes to shul. Well, if I haven't, I'll just say it quickly. Again, we'll play it on 2x speed. Okay. Guy comes to shul for the first time, and he sees the gabbai giving out the elios, and he gives one over here, and one over there, and the next one over there, and the one in the back and in the front. And he goes over to the gabbai and he says, "What a ridiculous, inefficient system. Why don't you start row one, seat one, and give him the first aliyah, then go to row one, seat two, and give the next guy, and keep going in an orderly fashion?" He says, "Is this your first time here?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "You're the fool. Why? Because if you saw the whole story, you'd understand. The guy in row one, seat one, got an aliyah last week. The guy in row seat two, his kid's getting bar mitzvah next week, and he's going to get an aliyah. The guy in row one, seat three, has yahrzeit in 2 weeks. He's going to get an aliyah." And he's able to explain why he... You show up for the first time and you got kashas? You got questions? Come on. This is the analogy. We show up on Earth 5,700 years into the game. 5,700 years have already transpired. How many of us have seen it? Yeah, I didn't think so. We look good for our age. And how many of us are going to be here at the very end? I don't know. But all of a sudden we have questions. We got God and say, "Well, how could you do something like this? I don't understand." That we're the guy who shows up to shul in the middle of a story. Yosef was given an opportunity to see a full picture from when he was 17 years old, being sold to slavery, to a point of where he's able to save his family and get them settled and see them proliferate tremendously. He went back to the pit to acknowledge where it all started and say, "Baruch Hashem." That's a whole different story. Now, why am I telling you this? Is because the brothers don't know that. The brothers don't understand why he's going back, and they came to a very logical conclusion, and that is he must be getting himself ready to take revenge. Why else would he do it? Who's right? Are the brothers right in suspecting Yosef? Is Yosef right in going to say Baruch Hashem at the pit where it all started? Who's right? Who's wrong? What's your take on it? And then I'll tell you what I think the right answer is.
They both are.
One?
They both are right.
They're both right. Well, how can they both be right? You're also
Well,
right. Yeah,
they both
I know that joke.
have their own feelings about what's going to transpire or what Joseph feels he needs to do.
Why are the brothers right? The brothers were wrong. They suspected him for something he was not guilty of. Do you remember we learned the Mishnah, Dan Lakav Schut, give people the benefit of the doubt. They didn't give him the benefit of the doubt.
What, by thinking he's going to take revenge on them?
Yeah, why they assume the worst? They should have said, maybe he's going. They should have racked their brains and say, maybe he's going to say, thank God.
Or probably over their own guilt and what they did wrong.
Maybe. So they were certainly biased in their view. They were certainly, looking at it through their their perspective. But you want to know the honest truth? They're both wrong. They're both wrong. Not they're both right. They're both wrong. The brothers are wrong for judging Yosef not favorably. They should have given him the benefit of the doubt, even if in their minds it was only a 0.1%. But that's a possibility, and they should have given him that. But here's the reason I'm sharing this with you. Yosef, who's 100% right in what he's doing, he left the door open for them to suspect him. That's on him. You have an obligation to be above board, to do the right thing, but you also have to take into consideration what are the impressions everyone else is going to have. You have to be concerned for that. I know it's not in vogue in today's society. Today's society, everybody stands on principle. I know I'm right. I'm not budging. This is the right thing to. And therefore, what? I had a teacher once and I wrote it down. It was so impactful for me. The teacher said, anytime somebody, whether it be a parent, an adult, a teacher, who says why they're making a big deal of it, it's right. It's not personal, it's the principle of the matter, right? You ever hear that expression? It's a lie. It's not true. If they're standing and saying it's the principle of the matter, no, they're taking it personally. They are. They really are. Nobody is so altruistic that they're making such a big deal. Why? Because it's the right thing. If it's the right thing, keep your mouth shut and do what's right. That's all. Why are you making such a big deal of it? You have to take into consideration what is the impression. The brothers were led to believe. Yosef should have at least tipped them off and say, hey, I just want you to know I'm going back to the pit, not because of any nefarious plot, but because I want to say thank you to Hashem for I got to see the big picture. He should have just sent a quick text. And if they don't use WhatsApp, go ahead. I don't care. Figure out a way to get the message across. That is what the Midrash tells us. We have to be worried about what is the perception of others. Even though, and again, I'm going to reiterate this, even though they have the obligation to give you the benefit of the doubt. So think how beautiful this Torah is. You and I have a different perspective. You see me do something, you have a responsibility to judge me favorably. But I have a responsibility to not leave the door open for you to judge me unfavorably. What a beautiful world this could be if we took this to heart. You know how many interpersonal relationship issues would be put off to the side if we were just a little bit more concerned? What would someone say? Am I putting them in a position to judge me unfavorably? What a better world it would be. Yeah, Fred.
Well, I learned this a long time ago, and I wonder if it comes from the same kind of meaning. It's a little different, but I was told once that if you shouldn't leave your car unlocked because you're allowing temptation for someone to steal the car. In other words, it's your responsibility for that car to be locked. If someone were to have gotten into it because you didn't lock it, you're kind of as almost as much as at fault as the person who took the car.
Yeah,
You know.
it's a biblical commandment where it says, "Lifnei iver lo titein michshol." In front of a blind person, don't put a stumbling block. It's not only the literal expression of in someone who's physically blind. It means you're putting some stumbling block for someone to make that transgression, for someone to commit the crime. You going ahead and leaving the door open, or let's say it better, leaving a sign, right, that says, open for business, you know, and it's not, you know, in Baltimore City, they make a big deal. They tell you to buy the club, you know, put over the steering wheel locks, right? A little part, I did buy it, and most of the time I put it on. A little part of me, you know, if I don't put it on, is like, you know, you're asking for trouble, T. You really are. You're not just tempting fate. I'm tempting reality. It's not just fate. So there is a concern both ways. Yeah, Jeff.
Joseph is always the good guy here, and the brothers are always the bad guys. But I want to put in a word for the brothers here,
Please.
because earlier in the story, much earlier in the story, they were threatened by Joseph when he told him about these dreams, that he would be subjugating them. And I imagine that they didn't forget about that. So it might have been not totally unjustified that they were afraid because of that.
I totally agree. I'm not suggesting that each of them is 100% wrong. There's an element of incorrect behavior on both sides. That's really the way I should have said it. You're right. I didn't want to imply that one was right, wrong. There was an element. They should have had a little bit more faith in Joseph. And Joseph, has an element of incorrect behavior because he should have tipped them off and not even leave that door open a crack for them to suspect him. There's an element on both sides. Let's go back to what we're talking about here. A judge has to remain impartial. The two litigants have to be dressed similarly. The law is the judge is not allowed to listen to one side of the litigants before the other one is even present. Even though the judge is going to listen to one before the other, you can't listen to both at the same time. So one by definition is going to go first, but he's not allowed to listen to the first one unless the second one is there. Why? Because it makes an impression and you have to, how are you going to undo that? You're going to accept this guy's word. We are so influenced by that. I can hold myself back as a judge and say, well, I recognize that's your view, but I see a guy over here who's going to tell me something different. So I know how to keep my balance. If the other guy's not here, I buy it hook, line, and sinker, even though I know in my head someone's going to say differently. But we're influenced that way. He always, even though the judge knows how much is at stake, we're told in this Mishnah, don't play the role of the lawyer. The lawyer, as Robin correctly said, is to present one side of a story passionately, intellectually, to present whatever argument it takes to show that side is correct. A judge can't do that. Not only that, a judge shouldn't even say, if you would have argued this way, it probably would have made a difference. The judge should not be doing that. That's not the judge's job, right? If the litigant wants to know, so judge, tell me, I'm not asking what your ruling is, but what do you think my chances are? The judge is not supposed to say that. That's not their job. Their job is to remain objective and impartial. Okay, that's the first thing. Okay? Let's look back here for a second. Let's go back to the Mishnah. Right? When sitting in judgment, do not act as a counselor at law. Now, when the litigants stand before you, consider them both wicked. Consider them both guilty, whichever version you want. The Mishnah here is very rough, very tough, but it fits so in line. You see, if you're a judge, I would be a terrible judge. Same reason I'm a terrible teacher because I give everybody the benefit of the doubt. I told you, right? If I had to give a true false question and the person wrote true and it was false, I'd give you the correct. Yeah, you were close enough, right? You can't be naive and assume, of course, the person's telling the truth. You have to have your antennas up as a judge, listening so carefully. Really? That's how you presented it? Well, and in your mind, not that you're outwardly saying anything, but you can't be naive. You can't be the one to just, it's okay. I recognize, he would never lie. I know him. I know her. Don't take anything for granted. Assume everybody's lying, and they have to prove their case. Check everything. That's how the only way you can remain. However, he finishes by saying, when they leave your courtroom, having accepted the judgment, then you can't hold a bias against even the losing party. Because what happens if that losing party comes into your courtroom again, a year, 2 years, 5 years from now? You have no right to say, "Oh, one second, one second. This guy's been here before. No, he was guilty." You can't do that. The minute they leave your courtroom and they've accepted it, they're not appealing it, they're not questioning it, they accept your judgment, everybody's good now. Everybody's back to being righteous. See how careful we have to be with how we approach this. Let's keep going. Let's look at nine. Shimon ben Shetach would say, "Have a marbe lachkor et ha'edim." One needs to be extremely careful and increasingly cross-examine the witnesses. Be careful with your words, lest they learn from them how to lie. Shimon ben Shetach is continuing the theme here, but he's switching the focus. This is not only on judges. This is not limited. He's adding to Yehuda's to Yehuda. Yehuda ben Tabai's teaching. It's not only the litigants who are biased. You got to check the witnesses. Witnesses can often, I shouldn't say that. Witnesses can lie. Witnesses can go ahead and decide they're going to say whatever needs to be said to support the view of a particular litigant. It is the job of the job of the jury, of the judge, to make sure to cross-examine, check the authenticity. During the interrogation, be careful not to ask leading questions that would indicate, oh, the judge is looking for this particular, oh, I know what to say. Okay. I had an incident when I was in Columbus. It was I won't go into all the gory details. It was an amazing experience, not in a positive way. It was Labor Day 1 year, and obviously the Beit Midrash was on the slower side. A lot of people were away. So normally my table where I used to give a class was on the far end of the room. But I had no class that night, so I went to go schmooze with a different one of the rabbis there who also didn't have a class, and his table was in the front of the kollel. His table was right near the door. And we're talking, and all of a sudden, a teenage boy, fairly decent size, tall, lanky but tall, wearing a cut-off, what do they call it? Wife beater undershirt, sleeveless, basketball shorts and sneakers, and he stands at the front glass door, about ready to come into the Beit Midrash, and he stands there for a moment. Okay, not that we haven't had guys like that, but it was a little out of the ordinary that a guy who we don't know would just be walking in like that. He stands there for maybe 5 seconds, and then he starts slowly walking into the Beit Midrash and walks himself to the right in front of the Aron, right in front of the Ark. Stands there. Okay, it's a little strange, but again, I'm watching, and all of a sudden, he grabs the pushka, he grabs the charity box, and makes a run for the front door. Well, having played middle linebacker in high school, it was a Jewish team, so I could play that position. It's okay, right? I fit the bill. I was good. Okay? I took the angle on it. I n grabbed him, knocked it out of his hand, and I'm holding him, wrapping him up. When out of the corner of my eye, I see another teenager coming in the front door, significantly larger than this one. And I know that this is not going to work out well. So he breaks free from my grip, and the two of them go running out the front door. The pushka's all the money's all over the floor. He didn't get it. I run out after them, and literally, as I'm running out, 2 doors down, our building was in a strip mall. 2 doors down, somebody was locking up their business and says, "Hey, what's going on?" As I said, these guys just try to rip off the charity box. He goes, really? Tells his business guy here, you finish locking up. He jumps into his pickup truck and he chases them. You're like, I'm not making this up. It's amazing. And long story short, his business partner said to me, oh, he works for Columbus City SWAT. Don't worry. He's an off-duty police officer. Fine. Maybe 2 minutes later, 3 minutes later, all of a sudden I hear, you hear the sirens coming from all different sides. And literally 2 minutes after that, there's a helicopter, a police helicopter. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is how much was in the pushcar already? You know, like, what are we talking about? What it turns out is that this guy cornered one of them, and the kid hopped the fence, and the officer tried to chase after him and fell. And he put out a distress call, officer down. Well, those two magic words, everybody comes out of the woodwork, but fine. Turns out they captured one of them, and I get a call about 3 weeks later. I get a call from an attorney saying, are you Rabbi Talkman? Yeah, does this story happen? Okay. This juvenile was now going in front of the magistrate, and I'm being asked to come down and, if need be, testify. Fine. Go down there. Again, reason for why I'm telling you this story, other than captivating your attention, is what I think the magistrate did was wrong. Here's how it played out. The teenager is on one side with an attorney, with a defense attorney, and his grandfather's behind him. On the other side is the prosecutor. There's no jury because it's just a magistrate, it's juvenile court, and the magistrate's sitting in front. And I'm, together with one or two other people, sitting in the gallery. Fine, let's call the court to order. Case number, blah, blah, blah. Against so and so, whatever his name was. Fine. Before we get started, she says, the magistrate says, before we get started, I just want to get one thing clear. Turns to the teenager and says, Mr. So and so, it's alleged that you have went into a house of worship and tried to steal the charity box. Mr. So and so, how low can you go? Well, I hear these words and I'm thinking, I don't need to testify. I'm good to go, right? She's already made up her mind, hasn't heard any evidence. I mean, the whole thing was over and done with before it started. That would not be okay in a Torah court. In a Torah courtroom, that would never fly. You cannot do that. The judge has one job: listen to the evidence presented and then make a ruling. I sat on a jury here in Baltimore City. There's no question in my mind the defendant was guilty, but the prosecution did a terrible job, an absolutely terrible job of making the case, and there were holes in the story. We all voted not guilty. Not a what? My job is to listen to the evidence, not what I feel, not what I want it to be. It's all based on fact. So the judge has to make sure he's not being biased and he's remaining impartial. You have to treat the litigants that they're trying to pull the wool over your eyes, and you better be on your A game. Make sure the witnesses are cross-examined well. Don't let anybody get away with it. Don't be influenced. He's such a community person. Of course, he must be telling the truth. No, absolutely not. Everything about this scenario of judgment and ruling and judges and witnesses, it has to be above board, all of it. Where this plays, why is this so important to be a teaching of Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach in particular? Okay. We can ask this question of any of the authors of the Mishnah. What was so unique that he chose this to be his teaching? I got to share one more thing with you. Let me hold on. Let me, here it is. Well, let me tell you an amazing story first about the greatness of Reb Shimon ben Shetach. Reb Shimon ben Shetach, the Talmud tells us an amazing story. It tells us that he sent some students to go purchase a donkey. He needed it for working the field or whatever it was. And he gave them the money. And sure enough, they bought it. And they returned back to Reb Shimon ben Shetach. And they're looking at it. They're examining the donkey and they're getting it ready to put whatever it is they put it to work. And they notice that hidden underneath the neck, where it was a lot of hair, there was hidden a gem, a jewel. And they went running to Reb Shimon ben Shetach and they said, "Rebbe, Rebbe, look at the great gift that God has bestowed upon you." He said, "What are you talking about?" And they told him the story. They went, they purchased the donkey, and along with the donkey came this jewel. He said, "You need to go return it back to the seller." They said, "But isn't the law that if a guy makes a mistake like that, you're not obligated to return it?" He said, "That may be the law, but that's not how we roll. That's not how we do it. And I want," he didn't use those expressions, that's Tzvi Tachman's way, okay? The Talmud didn't say that's how we roll, right? But that's what he said. He said, "No, even if the law is that way, go back and return it." In and of itself, it's a great story, but listen to the ending. They go back, and the seller is like, "What is everything okay?" They say, "Yeah, everything's fine, but hidden underneath, we found this jewel. Is it yours?" He said, "No. I didn't know anything about it." Now, at this point, technically, Reb Shimon ben Shetach is entitled to that jewel. Reb Shimon ben Shetach says, "Nevertheless, give it back to the seller. Give it back to him. Had he known that it was there, he would not have sold the donkey at that price. So it was a mistake on his part, but still." The non-Jewish seller exclaimed, "How wonderful, how great is Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach and the God who teaches him morals. The God who of Shimon ben Shetach." You hear that? In Hebrew, we call it a Kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name. He did above and beyond what he had to. And it was so impressive that the guy didn't say how great Shimon ben Shetach was. He didn't limit it to that. He immediately translated it and extrapolated to say, only somebody who has a moral compass from a God can come up with something like that. That was one of the greatness of Reb Shimon ben Shetach. But why is this teaching in particular so dear to him about cross-examining the witnesses? I'll tell you why. Because of a sad, tragic story. I'm going to read you the story straight out of the Talmud. It once happened that a Jewish tax collector who was very evil and a great scholar died on the same day in the same place. And all the people assembled, I'm reading you from the Talmud here, all the people assembled to attend the burial of the great scholar. At the same time, the relatives of the tax collector brought his casket for burial. Enemies of the tax collector attacked the group, so they all dropped both caskets and ran. One student, however, stayed there guarding the body of his rabbi. Sometime later, the town dignitaries returned to resume the burial of their great scholar, but the coffins of the rabbi and the tax collector somehow got exchanged, and the protests of the student were of no avail. So the relatives of the tax collector buried the great rabbi, which greatly distressed the student. Nor could he explain to himself what great sin had it caused the one to be buried in such a shameful way, and what great merit that the other, the tax collector, had brought about in his interment with such honor. The rabbi appeared to him in a dream and told him not to be distressed. And he goes on to describe what it is he felt he did wrong, and what this one act of goodness that the tax collector did. Story comes out. He says, "How long do I have to suffer?" He says, "Until Shimon ben Shetach dies." "Who will then replace him?" he was asked in this dream. He said, "Why?" He says, because there are women in Ashkelon who were practicing witchcraft. And Rab Shimon ben Shetach, who was the leader of that generation, did not bring them to judgment. Witchcraft is a biblical prohibition. The following day, the Talmud says, the student related his dream to Rab Shimon ben Shetach. He immediately assembled a group of men, distributed to each of them a jar with a cloak wrapped up inside of it. It was a rainy day, whatever. It was a whole ruse on how he was going to get these witches. Whoops, sorry. Well, I lost it. Right, where'd it go? Where'd it go? Sorry, I just clicked on the wrong thing here. Oh, here it is. Fine. Okay, Rav Shimon ben Shetach took care of the witches. Fine. Da, 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 da. I'm just skipping down to the end here. The relatives of the witches were incensed. Two of them came forward and perjured themselves by testifying that Shimon ben Shetach's son had committed a certain crime that was punishable by death. And the witness's testimony was accepted and he was condemned to death. When the perjurers or whatever, long story short, whatever, I don't want to go through the whole thing. I should have prepared this ahead of time. But the point being, Shimon ben Shetach lost his son to two witnesses who lied under oath and perjured themselves. Real story. So Shimon ben Shetach isn't just giving us good advice. He's talking from heartache. He's talking from personal experience of where if the judge is not careful, and it just, how could it be? How can he just willing to accept without the due diligence, then it leads to trouble like this. Okay. Let me finish with one last piece. What time is it? Okay, we're good. One last piece. Do you know why this is so important for us? There's nobody on this call that's a judge. Maybe we have attorneys, but we don't have judges, to the best of my knowledge, right? So why am I wasting 47 minutes of your time when the Mishnah doesn't seem to be relevant? Oh, my friends, it is extremely relevant. Do you know how hard it is for you to judge yourself? Honestly, you think it's only for judges who sit and listen to someone else's case who have to remain objective, impartial, and not be biased and influenced by something else? You know how hard it is to look inward and judge yourself objectively? When you do something wrong, how quick are we to rationalize it? Don't answer it. I'll answer it for you. I do it. We all do it. You want to know my proof? God knows we do it that way. Therefore, he gave us an amazing time on the calendar called the 10 Days of Repentance. We spend an entire day going like this. No, I did do it. I'm not going to fake it. I'm not going to lie to myself anymore. Aren't we judging ourselves biasly? Over and over and over again, we do it. This Mishnah is not just for someone who wears the black robe as an official judge. It's talking to you and me. And we become so caught up in our biases that we can't see beyond it. Do we give the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, the same time and the same ability to argue his case as we do the Yetzer HaTov, the good inclination? Do we give them equal time? Or do we just say, no, of course, the Yetzer HaTov, no, he would never lie. I wouldn't do something like that. When I see my friend do it, my natural reflex is, oh, that stinker. How could he do something like that? Yet when I do it, I'm like, no, it's okay. It's not that bad. Really? I can judge him one way and judge me the other way? What happened to impartiality? I want to share with you two stories in Tanakh. Two stories. one by a name Hananiah ben Atzur. This is in the book of Jeremiah. Right? He's warned that if he continues doing this terrible things that he's doing, the prophet says, you will die this year. You will die this year in the seventh month, right before Rosh Hashanah. Okay? You will die. That's what the prophet tells him. The Midrash tells us that he died Erev Rosh Hashanah. He died the day before Rosh Hashanah. But before he died, he commanded his children that they not take him out until the next day on Rosh Hashanah. Why? So that he can have the last laugh that the prophet was a liar. He said, I would die this year. Rosh Hashanah started a new year. Put yourself in this perspective here. The guy knows his goose is cooked. He's wrong. He's been read his last rites. He's not willing to budge. His last act on earth is to up is to try to, what's the word I'm looking for? To
one up.
To one up. Yeah. To one up the prophet. Right? That's gonna be his last hurrah. Are we crazy? What is wrong with us? But we become so biased that our way is the right way. And even when we know we're facing what proves to be we're wrong, we're not willing to go down. We're not willing. We're going to take one last swing as we go down. Next story, also in Tanakh. This one is even crazier. I think this one's crazy. This is found in the book of Kings, Kings 1, the story of Chiel. Let me give you the background. When the Jewish people conquered the land of Israel, what's the first city that they had to conquer? To come into the land. First one.
Jericho.
Jericho, very good. Jericho. Okay? Joshua leads the conquest. He leads that battle. And the Jewish people win, but he tells the people, do not take from the spoils. Hands off. Nobody should take. Okay? Number one. Number two, he puts a curse and says the city of Jericho shall not be rebuilt. It is to remain in ruins. Okay? Comes along quite a few generations later, a fellow by the name of Chiel. Chiel is a builder. Chiel decides he is going to rebuild Jericho. He's going to rebuild it. But somebody reminds him, the prophecy of Joshua was very clear that anybody who is going to rebuild Jericho will start with his first digging of the foundation. He will lose his oldest child. And by the time he puts the last brick in the building, he will have lost his last child. All his children will die. Look it up, folks. It's in Joshua. Again, I recommend the book. Okay? So you have, this is the warning, and everybody knows this. And Chiel goes ahead and he said, as he's laying the foundation, his oldest child has a heart attack, his oldest child dies. Again, we consider ourselves intelligent people. Chiel, I'm sure, was an intelligent person. He's not an imbecile. Yet, he continues. And he continues to build. And one after the other, after the other, such that the last child died when he was putting up the gate of the city. How could a person do this? Is he really that dumb? No, he's not. He is human. We entrench ourselves. It seems incomprehensible how a person can witness the demise of their entire family and not stop immediately. How do we do it? Because of our inability to admit that maybe we're not right. It's so hard. Because we are biased. We are not objective. If we were, we would be better. These two Mishnayos, the Mishnah from Yehuda ben Tabai and the Mishnah of Shimon ben Shetach, having this one theme, whether you're acting as a judge in an official capacity or you're acting as a witness to something that happened, or you are just living your life, are you being true to yourself? Are you being honest with yourself? It's not easy. We have what's called negiut. We have biases. It's the way it goes. The Torah doesn't say you can't have a bias. That's not humanly possible. What the Torah says is that you have to be able to recognize the bias and to come up with a strategy to try to the best of your ability to be honest and fair about yourself and about your relationship with others. That to me is really what this is all about. This is really the introduction to the Yom Kippur confession, right? We're ready to recite all the admissions left and right, but it starts with, for we are not so brazen, right, and obstinate as to say that we are righteous, but rather we and our ancestors have sinned. Really? That's the introduction? Why can't you just say, I rebelled, I'm guilty? Just jump right in. You need a whole lot. Can you imagine? Before you do anything, you have to say, well, I'm not so brazen as to say I'm a good teacher. Really, I'm not. Like, that's ridiculous, right? How are you going to introduce it every single time? And yet there's an introduction. We're not so brazen to say that we're not guilty. Oh, but we are. Isn't just the act of pounding your chest and saying, I'm guilty enough? Why the introduction? The answer is because the root of this brazenness is the source for our inability to admit our mistakes. Because we always want to be right. The Mishnah here is telling us, you got to look yourself in the Mishnah and judge yourself objectively. You're not always right. Look yourself honestly in the mirror and say, I should be better. I need to be better. I really want to do this, but I have to be honest with myself, right? We'll end with this. I have to get over a hump in terms of my exercise and my food and my diet. I've been working really hard and Baruch Hashem is paying off. But for many, 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 many months, years, I knew I had to do it. I just wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to look myself in the eye and say, hey, now's the time. Stop making excuses and just, you have to do it. My personality is, I have to make up my mind. If I make up my mind, thank God I can stay focused for quite a while. And that's my gig. But I got to make up my mind. I have to be able to look myself in the eye and say, Ad kan, no more. That's what we have to do. We have to look ourselves in the eye and say, I need to judge myself honestly. Honestly. I got to judge myself honestly. And that means that I have to be honest with myself of where I need to improve. That's what it is. So it's not, the Mishnah is not limited to real judges. It's to each one of us as we judge others, and as importantly, how we judge ourselves to remain objective. That's how these two work together. Any thoughts? Any ideas? Randy? You did?
Two things come to mind. One, how about if you're too harsh on yourself? Is that
you're
the
not
same,
being, then you're not being objective either. A judge has to be honest. It doesn't mean he has to come down and rule. He can rule with leniency, but he has to know the facts. First, look yourself in the eye. Look yourself in the mirror and say, no, I need to change this. I need to do this better. How can I? I'm not going to jump off the ship, you know, and go to the nth. Okay, I got to be smart about it. I'm not going to be so hard on myself that it becomes debilitating. Then I'm not going to gain anything.
And then, funny story, my sister-in-law and brother-in-law were telling about one time when they were at the beach And my brother-in-law said, I left my keys at the outdoor pool. And my sister-in-law says, no, it was the indoor pool. And they argued about it back and forth. And finally, my wife, as a social worker, said, would you rather be happy or right? And they both at the same time, right. It didn't matter where. He could have just said, I left my keys at the pool.
Yep. Yes. To be right. That's another winning expression, right? That we do at all costs. No. I'd much rather be happy than right. Before I get your question, Jeff, I got to acknowledge, is that my boy Noah? Get out of here. How are you, sir?
Rabbi Talkman, how are you?
I'm great. Noah, you bring such a smile to my face. Wow.
I am actually here with a genuine question.
Okay.
So I had a friend recently passed, past couple of days.
I'm sorry. That's so sad.
Am I able to say a Kaddish for him as a non-Jew?
He's a non-Jew?
Yes, sir.
I don't know if you would say Kaddish. I think what you should do is that you should put in a, if you want, say a memorial prayer.
Yes, sir.
I think that would be very appropriate. And if I can be so bold,
please.
You can use this. I'm sure your mom can show you a text of what
please,
we have as
please
a memorial
be bold.
Prayer. But I want to be bold and say, Noah, add your own words to it.
Okay.
It should be something personal that you feel that you would want to express.
Yes, he was a very close friend of mine. Unfortunately, circumstances did not provide him the opportunities that we might have had, but here we are.
Okay, I'm so sorry to hear that. If you want to call me and talk, I'm more than happy.
I would love to. My mother will gain your contact.
I think she has. I think she has myself, but I'll.
I got him on speed dial. Already.
Yeah,
fantastic. I would love
okay.
to talk to you, Tucker.
I would be happy to do that. Noah, it is wonderful to see you.
I am blessed and honored to see your face on this.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I look forward to speaking with you.
Sorry about that.
All right, Jeff, you're up.
Well, I think we're about out of time, but I was just going to mention that the Daf Yomi, the group that's going through the Talmud one page at a time, is now doing Sanhedrin. And Sanhedrin is an entire tractate of Talmud that addresses these questions of the fairness of judges and the fairness of witnesses. And there's a lot of stuff on YouTube if you look at Daf Yomi and you're interested in this topic. That's all they're going to talk about for the next 3 weeks.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Some of the laws that apply, like I was telling you, in terms of how the judge interacts with the litigants, how they interact with each other, what's acceptable, how do you interrogate witnesses, from something as simple as, you know, the new moon, how do you go through that process, right, to a capital crime. It's all in there. It's fascinating. Good point, Jeff. Robin.
Yeah, so you need to teach this class to the judges that I work with, which is maybe 90% of the judges for the whole state, okay? Because a couple things, like one, which is really wrong, especially for our clients, my clients, they're trying to protect their children. And so they will go and they will, you know, based on the evidence they have, it doesn't always, not enough. Always. So sometimes their cases are dismissed until they get other evidence that's more, I guess it's more compelling, but the judges always hold it against them, which is the sad thing. Like you said, you know, if you look at somebody and then they were guilty, like if they keep coming back, they always have a bias and that's horrible.
Yeah.
And we know this. And so we know if it's a similar judge, like there's certain judges I know, there's only maybe a handful that are good that I think are not going to be biased, which is sad. But the other point I wanted to make was, the cross-examination, that's like what I have to do a lot, obviously, for my cases. And I actually, like you were saying, not to lead them. I mean, it's very different, but I do want to lead them because a lot of times you lead them in a story that shows that they're lying. So, you know, you have very logical evidence that something happened and they're coming up with something that's wacky. And I'll be like, oh, well then, oh, you're saying that this happened. And then they believe their lies. So then they go with it. They're, oh, yeah, that happened. Then they'll keep going. And I'm like, oh, explain to me. And then it gets into, so much more that you can tell, and the judge can tell that they're lying.
So it's a good point. Let me clarify. When I said not to use leading questions, I mean don't lead them that they know what to say so that they can win the case.
Okay.
That's what I meant. Because then the judge is tipping his hand what he's looking for to make it a factual thing. Don't let, exactly like you're saying, let them tell their story. Then you can poke holes in it. If you, as the attorney, can help that along, there's nothing wrong with that. But as the judge, don't ask those kinds of leading questions to get clarification because then they know what to answer.
Right. And then sometimes though, I don't know. Sometimes the judges do. They don't do a great
It's
job.
not, it's not, I don't want it to be this is a law that you're not allowed to ask a leading question.
No,
That's not
I
what,
understand that, but I'm just
this is a
saying.
general principle of not tipping your hand of how to play the card. That's not your job as a judge.
Right. I'm just
Muriel.
sorry.
Yeah,
Thank you.
I am not comfortable with the judge assuming both parties are guilty. Why not assume that they're both innocent?
Because then you won't be as on your game to look at each thing that's said. If you work with an assumption that people are innocent, so then you have the luxury of, yeah, what they're saying must be true. Okay, they said it funny, but I'm sure they're telling it. If I'm assuming that you're here to pull the wool over my eyes, I am going to be on you like a hawk. And I'm going to be focused, super. I'm going to be uber focused to make sure that what you're saying is accurate. Is consistent. If I give you always that innocence, then I can, I can smooth over a couple of rough patches with just a, that's not really the way he meant it, but I go in with the assumption that it's not true. I want to be proven one way or another. That's why it says. But Muriel, don't forget, the end of it is that when you render the decision, they both walk out as completely righteous. Even the one who is found guilty is righteous because he accepted it. And maybe he did tshuva. Maybe he paid back what he was supposed to. Then it's a clean slate. And everybody, you see the guy out in the street, he's as good as the next guy. But
But
the
isn't
minute.
that a contradiction with the benefit of the doubt?
No, not as a judge. No, you can't give him. Well, that's really what he meant. Again, I'd be a terrible judge. He said true, he meant false. All right, close enough. No, as a judge, you have to make sure facts are facts. You can't, well, he meant that. State what you mean and let's just get clarity. So I will be much more in tune with it if I'm assuming the worst as opposed to just, yeah, I got the gist. You can't get the gist as a judge. You got to get facts. Can't work with an assumption.
I would be a terrible
Yeah.
judge. I just not lightweight.
Well, believe me, there's not that many good ones. I hate to say it, but
Ay
there's a very handful that are.
vey.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yes,
Yeah.
Fred. You're on mute.
Sorry about that. When I want to go back to Joseph. When I've reread the story of you, the area that I realized that he was actually, all right, wasn't he actually acting, what's the word I want to use now? Okay, he was bragging. Wasn't he bragging that he was the favorite? I mean, he obviously was the favorite of his brothers, but that
Well,
coat that he had, in other words, I read somewhere where he was bragging to his brothers that, I mean, the dreams he had, it was like,
he's wearing a special garment that his father gave only him. That's
Right.
pretty that's a pretty loud expression of favoritism.
What I'm saying is he's showing, but should, in other words, was he wrong in that respect that he shouldn't have allowed the, even if he was the favorite, that shouldn't have, he shouldn't have kind of rubbed it into his brothers that
Good
I'm
question.
the favorite,
That's a good question. My gut tells me yes, but he didn't have a lot of wiggle room because those two dreams that he had to be shared. And those two dreams about the brothers, symbolically bowing to him and accepting his leadership, That's not just a dream. We see from the whole story as it plays out, that's a prophecy. This is God's way of telling him, this is the path in which it's going to go. How it's going to play out, who's going to play what role, it's not clear. I mean, that's where his perhaps his fault of having the jealousy of the brothers and the brothers being at fault of acting out on it, all that is true. I forget who says it, maybe the Talmud, maybe a commentary, I don't remember. If everything had gone smoothly, this same prophecy would have been fulfilled, except we would have gone down to Egypt in chariots. We would have gone down with food. We would have settled nicely. There wouldn't have been any of this terrible sibling rivalry. Instead of going down in such harsh conditions, we could have gone down in a great way. But those were personal decisions that people made, the brothers made and Joseph made. So I hear where you're coming from.
And very quickly, when you say a judge, what about if I've never been on a jury, and probably I never will be at this point, but what about a jurist? Should they also take the same aspect that look at the both of them as though they're guilty and then.
For all intents and purposes, that is the job of the jury. There is no such thing as a jury system in the Torah. There's no such thing as being judged by a panel of your peers. There's no such thing.
So each jurist is a judge.
And, well,
Basically.
isn't it? They're making a ruling on whether what they're hearing from the defendants, the litigants, true or not. They're making decisions there. Now,
Yeah, and the idea that.
the judge's role is to facilitate as to what they should take into account, what's the law that they have to weigh, but facts, how they hear it, the judge doesn't play that role. That's supposed to be the job of the jury. They are that judge in that aspect.
So they should, as a jurist, you should look at both people, prove to me you're innocent, kind of thing.
Or no, or prove to me guilty. They
Or prove
both
to me
have to
you're,
prove. All I know is that there is somebody who's being accused of X. Somebody has to prove to me one way or another. And I'm assuming they're both lying through their teeth, so I got to figure out who's telling the truth.
Yeah, it's easier to
Prison.
take it that way than to say, they're both innocent, prove to me they're guilty. If you start the other, you're going to be looking for more accurate information.
Correct. That's why I'm saying that's why the initial should be assume they're lying so that you're paying very close attention. Susan.
Is there, it struck me when you raised up that Joseph had the incredible opportunity to actually see how everything played out. Is there any commentary about that? And I can't think of anyone else who got that privilege. Is there anyone else?
Well, I mean, there's big pictures and there's small pictures, you know.
Well, this is
How
a pretty
about
big picture.
here? How about Avraham and Sarah going down to Egypt and Sarah being abducted? Right? You got to scratch your head on that one. Like, what's the story with that? And how does that play out? Well, the end of the story is that they walk away richer than ever because God intervenes and Pharaoh just heaps tremendous riches upon them. I mean, without getting too far afield here, right? That's actually the source of why the city of Goshen was chosen. Why did the family, when they came down to Egypt, they settled in the city of Goshen? Why there? Oh, because it's on the outskirts, it's not in the city proper. But I'm sure there was another city there also. The answer is because Goshen was given to Sarah by the king of Egypt, Pharaoh. Oh, most people don't know that. Yeah. So it's been in the family, so to say, for a few generations. But go figure that out. You can't the challenge, Susan, that you're presenting, I don't have a great answer to it. Because looking forward on an incident to see how it plays out, nobody can do. Nobody.
Yes.
Not a Moses, not a Joseph.
Yes,
You can't.
but
Can you do it backwards?
exactly. Yes.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
Sometimes though.
You can never do it forward. That is a dangerous way of living.
Yeah.
But you could do it. Sometimes we're gifted, we're able to see some small piece to it. But who knows? We won't know until the final picture is revealed and we see all the pieces come together.
Didn't Moses get to see everything?
Nope.
I mean, he wrote
He
the
learned
future.
everything, but he had the same question we all grapple with. He asked God to show him his glory, and God says, "You cannot." What does that mean? What does he want to see? What color hair God has? Like, what does that mean? He wants to see what glory? He wants to see, he wants to understand everything of God's ways. And when he hits the wall of why do bad things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people, God says you can't comprehend it in your human existence. It's not humanly possible. We are limited people. We are physically limited. We are emotionally limited. We are spiritually limited. We are limited.
He
To
also wouldn't let.
understand that aspect of God is beyond human comprehension.
He also wouldn't let Moses kind of finish the story and get into the promised land.
There's a reason for that also.
Yeah.
You know, we have the luxury of looking back and seeing why, but Moses didn't. He questioned it, but he was told this is not appropriate. Randy, last piece.
Is that the same thing when you say, gee, I wonder why that person did whatever he did? He says, I can't figure out why, let's say, somebody did something and you can't explain why they decided what they decided. Is that kind of the
It's
same thing?
true. It's true. And I like the approach. The one difference is that people can do things incorrectly, meaning the person may have a terrible reason for doing it and might be wrong for doing it. That same assumption doesn't work with God, because we work with the assumption that everything God does is ultimately good. So I may not be privy to see it that way, but I'm willing to, so to say, give him the benefit of the doubt that it is good. I may not see it. I don't have that luxury when it comes to something you do or I do, because maybe we're wrong. But I like your approach of giving people that wiggle room to say, okay, maybe I don't understand why they do what they do. I'm okay with that. All right, a lot to think about. All right, have a great rest of the evening. Stay warm, and God willing, we will continue this again next week.